Hey, we're Amy and Christina, two friends who got pregnant around the same time, started an Instagram to vent about how much we didn't know, and realized there were a ton of you out there who felt the exact same way.
Who'd have thought? Not us. But once we realized we weren't the only ones frantically Googling things at 3 a.m., we thought, why not take it up a notch?
And here we are with a podcast. We're bringing in the experts on all things pregnancy, parenting, and women's health because, let's be real, we're all just trying to survive this journey.
So whether you're here for the real talk, expert advice, or just need some adult conversation between diaper changes, we got you. Welcome to the What I Wish I Knew podcast. Thanks for being part of our growing community.
Hi, Heather.
Hi.
Very, very excited to have you on. I know you're super busy, so really appreciate it. And it's great to formally meet you.
Awesome. No, it's a pleasure. Yeah.
So why don't we start by just tell us a little bit about yourself and we'll take it from there.
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Heather Mayone. I'm a therapist in private practice in Manhattan. And my training is originally in art therapy, in creative arts therapy. But I've been, this is terrifying, doing this for 20 years this year. over time, the career has ebbed and flowed, and I've gotten an increased interest in my more sort of like psychodynamic, psychoanalytic leaning, verbal therapy, and do all sorts of work with kids and teens and adults and couples and families.
So what do you feel like is unique about working with families in specific?
Well, what's amazing about, like, it's almost like the more people you have in the room, the more of a capacity you have to impact and to understand, right? And so if I'm just working with an individual kid or an individual adult, that's great. You know, like, that's wonderful. That's juicy. That brings me so much joy. But when you actually get the whole system in the room, first of all, it is so much information, right? You can see the roles that everyone is playing. You can begin to really understand, you know, people's unique point of view. Like, there's this rule in systems therapy that there's no such thing as like an identified patient. There's no such thing as a bad guy. Even if I begin to notice that I'm maybe like siding with someone or like feeling not so happy with someone, you know, you get to really pause and reflect on, okay, well, how is that role serving the system? But one thing that was like challenging about not having that family therapy buy-in right from the beginning is it does set up a little bit, your kid is the patient.
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, but it could lend itself to like your kid is the problem. You know, we really want to understand the full picture and also give everyone support. Like, some kids are tough, you know, like some kids, just like their substance, like what they're made of, you know, and some of these things are traits. Like, I have a son who's very headstrong, which I think brings unique challenges as a parent. But something I remind myself of is, you know, if his dad and I play this right, he's going to be like a kick-ass adult. Like, that is such a great personality trait to have as an adult.
Yep. Which is not without its challenges now, like you're saying. But
lots of
big payoff.
Lots of challenges. Totally. So, yeah, you just have more of an opportunity to impact and to build relationships with everyone equally. You know, if I'm seeing a kid and the parents come in, you know, and they don't really know me that well. Like, you really have to have a strong relationship with someone to, I don't know, like, raise challenging stuff, or like for that person to feel safe and secure enough to talk about things that are really vulnerable to talk about as a parent. Like, maybe some things you don't like about your kid, for example. You know, for some parents, that's really hard to admit. That's really hard to acknowledge that there are some things about their kids that's crazy.
Not parenting, even if it's not specific to your kid, it could be, but things about parenting that they don't like. Because I also feel like the narrative around particularly for women, around being a parent is that you're supposed to love it. You know, you should soak up every moment. And the reality is there are parts of parenting that suck, that are really hard, maybe that don't feel natural to you or don't feel good. So I feel like therapy is one place where you can actually unpack what's going on or talk about it or have, you know, an empathetic ear or whatever it is that you need. Therapy would offer that to you if you feel comfortable enough to open up and, you know, talk about those things that people don't really want to talk about that often.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, in the simplest terms, someone were to like write out in black and white, like what parenting is, it's like, would you like to give up your freedom? Like, would you like to give up freedom, flexibility, autonomy, independence, sleep, money? You know, it's like energy, time. Like, how does that sound? Does that sound good to you?
And, you know, do it for like a couple decades, if you don't mind. That'd be great. Thank you so much.
I mean, something that really drew me, you know, throughout my career to a more kind of like psychoanalytic lens is there's this concept of neutrality, which doesn't mean I'm neutral, I have no opinions, but it means that the best therapy is when you're able to create a relationship and enough safety and enough security where everything can be welcomed and looked at and explored. And the ugliest parts of ourselves, the most shameful parts of ourselves, the parts of us that we want to hide, that we're able to hold and examine and give voice to all of it. And then comes understanding, right? And then maybe comes interpretation, maybe, right? But that the first step is to be able to say the things. And it is so remarkable how many parents have this, you know, kind of overactive superego, you know, that I think a lot of times, you know, self-judgment and shame can even get in the way of saying the thing. But when you get to that point where they're saying the thing, you can actually examine the thing, but also examine that judgment, right? The feeling about the feeling.
Right.
You know, that's when you can really see what factors have impacted what standards someone is holding themselves to, right?
When it comes to those standards or when it comes to, let's say, what people seem hesitant to talk about, what are some of those patterns or commonalities you've seen among new parents that's unique to that audience? What are some of the things that you feel like come up a lot or challenges that you see in that particular group of people?
So on the surface, if I have a patient that I have an existing relationship with, or if I have a new patient who is struggling with like, oh, I think I may have postpartum, what I'll see on the surface is a profound overwhelm and versions of this feels so hard. I don't know why this feels so hard. No one told me it was going to be this hard. It doesn't look hard for that person. What is it about me? Are they just better at hiding it? And almost like a kind of disorientation. And again, not to paint with a broad brush, but often what will play out in treatment are a combination of two things. One is there is actually something very troubling and misogynistic to me about even the framing of postpartum depression, because who is the patient? It's patientifying women. Like, not every woman is the one to, you know, carry the child. Certainly people who adopt children or have a surrogate can experience postpartum symptoms. But, you know, if a woman has just carried a child, we also don't know what her journey was to even have that child, right? There's all sorts of ways that, you know, through infertility journeys, miscarriages, that there's all of this trauma and mourning that doesn't get properly processed before you know, they're able to actually reach their goal and have the child. So there are also scenarios where someone will have a child and they're still grieving a stillborn, or they're still grieving five IVF cycles and how brutal that was and how isolating that was. But I think the framing of postpartum, it ignores real things that happen to our body, real hormonal changes that are happening. If you're breastfeeding, you know, talk about loss of freedom. Even if that goes well, that shit fucking hurts in the very beginning. Even the best case scenario.
Yep.
I was blessed with a good fear. We had a good experience, but whew, man, big boobies. I mean, that shit was bananas.
No one. But we should have a whole episode just at. In fact, I know we're going to have a whole episode just on breastfeeding or feeding your baby or combo feeding or whatever. Because don't get me started on the pressure to breastfeed.
Totally.
And all of that. So we're going to have to dive into that later.
You know, the symbolism of feeding. Oh, you're not a good feeder. You know, like, but why are we patientifying women? What about the system? What about who they chose to have that baby with? Right? When you go from, again, some people have children on their own as singular people. Some people have children with their gay best friend. I don't know. It takes all types, right? But if you're looking at the sort of air quotes, typical dyadic relationship, you go from a twosome to a threesome. That takes a profound amount of reorganization. All resources in the dyad now need to be spread through a triad. And oftentimes, just because of the organic setup of, you know, if you're breastfeeding, if you're the one who gave birth, if you're the primary caregiver, we have an isolation problem. And even when you have a really supportive partner who's like helping with night feedings, there's just no way to make it equal, right? And so I think that postpartum issues, even if the woman is symptomatic, always needs to be looked at as a systems issue, What imbalance is happening to cause one partner to be so underwater? I mean, the other thing that I talk about a lot with new parents generally, but especially new mothers, is mothering raises things about how you were mothered. And that can look so many ways. You know, I had one patient who came into session with maybe her 6-week-old baby strapped to her chest in a little booth and said, "I am so mad. This is so much easier than I thought it would be." And listen, that statement you don't hear often, but what this person was speaking to is her parents were a fucking disaster. They couldn't do basic things. They couldn't get food on the table. But it wasn't until that patient actually had her feet in the shoes of parenthood that she could fully take in her own neglect, right? But even going back to this, you know, if you weren't fed, and again, that isn't just the food type, but that's in all of the ways, emotionally, psychically, spiritually, with love, you know, you don't always become the best feeder. And so if you're sort of struggling to self-feed and self-parent as it is, when you now need to parent someone new, like that to me is one of the main causes of this thing that we call postpartum depression.
As part of sort of like digging into that, do you also find that people can experience parenting as a sort of like cathartic experience where, you know, they did have a really shitty childhood or bad parents or whatever it was, and that by seeing what they don't want to do, they're able to sort of heal a little bit in what felt bad before, because the way that they are treating their children is how they wish they would have been treated themselves. Like, does that ever happen? What does that look like?
I mean, that absolutely happens. because as parents, all we want to do is feed our kids. So to be able to have the gratifying experience of, you know, as hard as this is, as much as I didn't have that, I'm figuring out how to do it for my kid. And also to experience, ideally, like one of the needs, sort of capital N needs that we have as humans, growing up at least, is a sort of secure base and unconditional love. And so if you don't get that, but you're able to provide it. I mean, as parents, we can't hang our identities on our kids loving us, right? That's a dangerous trap. But I also think that allowing yourself to take pleasure and take in how much this little being loves you and what good stuff you're giving them absolutely can be healing. And listen, I think even people who don't have, I don't know, complicated past or complex trauma, like ideally all parents are doing some version of reflecting on like, what do I want to be doing here? Like, what's my orientation? Like, what did I like in my upbringing? And what do I want to do different? You know, but in my experience, people who do have more kind of traumatic backgrounds and didn't have that essential sort of secure base do also hold themselves to way too high at a standard. Because I think the fear that their child could be experiencing even an iota of what they experienced is probably one of their biggest fears.
That makes total sense. It's almost like, how did I feel when this did happen to me? That was so terrible. I can't believe I did that too. Or maybe I should have done it differently. I could see how that could bring up a lot of second guessing too, or instead of just trusting your instincts and your gut and how you want your kid to feel, you're sort of pulling in all of your past, which I could see how that becomes sort of like a spiral or a swirl.
Yeah. I mean, there is something useful, therapeutically useful about when patients have kids, because if they are talking about something historical that happened at a certain age, you know, say their kid's name is John, can say, think about John. Think about John experiencing that. Think about where John is at developmentally, and how sweet he is and how innocent he is and what his day-to-day life is like. Think about him dealing with something like that, you know? And I think that there are ways that a projection, you know, can make a parent be harder on themselves or be a really challenging thing. And then there's a way that the projection can almost turn into a connection. I think it's very important to, you know, for healing to really reconnect to the ages where you experienced these things. Because I really think it helps understanding, but it also helps self-compassion, right? Going back to this thing that I said so many new mothers say to me, like, why is this so hard? You know, there will come a point in our treatment where we answer that question. And you know, it's not because they're bad parents. That there's a little preview. It's not because they're bad parents.
Right.
It's never that. Maybe there's some things they need to figure out. Maybe there are some blind spots they have. Maybe they're acting really neurotic in a way, you know.
How do you think that being a mom, because you have one son, he's how old now?
He's 7 and a half.
7 and a half.
Yeah.
How do you think that being a mom sort of informs your approach to working with patients who are parents? Yeah. And I am going to ask you also how being a therapist then affects your parenting style, because I'm assuming it kind of goes both ways. It's impossible to extricate one from the other. But let's start with the mom. How do you think that plays into your work with patients?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first off, becoming a mom as a therapist, you know, they talk about like nature and nurture. So obviously I'm a believer in nature, but I'm such a believer in nurture. I'm a believer in, you know, that we're social creatures. We're really impacted by our surroundings. We're most vulnerable to be impacted when we're young, you know. And also I think coming from a nurture point of view gives a lot of hope as far as our abilities to grow and change and, you know, self-nurture, get some good nurturing, get some good growing and you know, develop skills that we need to have to be kind of happier and more satisfied. becoming a parent really made me a believer in nature. My son, his name is Cass, is like really who he is. And I mean, I'm a fan of his. I'm a really big fan of his. But, you know, again, there are like some personality traits that he has. First off, that are like different than mine. I mean, I have strong values, but this way that he's very headstrong, for example, what I mentioned earlier, it's just him. You know, maybe there's some nature in that, but that has just always felt like him. And this maybe actually is a segue to my other thought about how parenting has affected my kind of view as a therapist. Like, you know, I think that so much of my journey as a parent has been like, okay, so Cass is him and I'm me. Given who we are, how do we make this work? Like, how do we make this work? You know, for example, I don't know, I'm like a little bit of a hippie. I'm like a kind of laid back, like, and there are some things that Cass needs from me that aren't super in my comfort zone.
Like what?
Like, I think that he needs stronger limits. And I'm not like a limit free, you know, that's sort of also not my orientation, but, you know, because it's very much in my values to, you know, I want Cass to be resilient and adaptive, you know, and to be able to thrive in a lot of different environments. But I think the level of firmness he needs at times is very much outside of my comfort zone. And so I've had to do some work on my aggression in my own therapy. and also tolerating his discomfort, you know, and if I do feel like I need to set a hard limit, you know, he's not going to make it easy for me. I really have had to grow around my ability to tolerate, you know, the discomfort that follows. There are also times where he does need me to be flexible, and that we can do much more naturally and organically and in tandem. And those are those sort of moments that are much more kind of magic, I think, in our relationship. But that's a way that, you know, he's been tough for me.
That kind of goes back to what you were talking about with the, like, looking at a system versus an individual or a specific patient, because without knowing so much about the kid in this scenario, how would anyone know why you were feeling the way that you were or what you were struggling with? Because it wouldn't just be you in isolation, you being like, I don't know, I just feel like my kid never listens to me or whatever the issue is, without also exploring the dynamic of who the kid is and why they are responding that way or what they need from this person or whatever. I feel like it would be a lot harder to figure out the path forward or what the actual issue was and how to address it or talk about it in isolation.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that like this is a case, say Cass needed to go to therapy, you know, it's like my history and my, again, orientation, like all my backstory would be really important. It would be really, really, really important to know, you know, to actually help. Like, there are some standard things that are best practices, you know, in parenting. But I don't know. It's like, that's what the internet is for. Like, there's so much fucking information on the internet now. Like, you go to a therapist, you go to a specialist to get specialized, thoughtful, curated guidance that is specifically for you and specifically for your child and specifically for whoever else is in the mix, right? Because again, if I had a different kid, my parenting journey would be different. If Cass had a different mom, his childhood would be different. The Cass plus Heather magic is very special magic. It's very unique. makes me think about like the other thing, the other way that I've grown. And I think this is a big one kind of in my role as a therapist is, you know, I think that when I do give parents guidance, it has to fit them, right? It kind of has to fit their nature, right? Their what fabric they're made of, what comes naturally to them. And if I see something, I don't know, very, very concerning, or you have a very flex parent and a kid who needs a ton of limits, there may be actually some things that that kid needs that's like a bridge too far for that parent in that moment, you know, and maybe there's some more work that's needed to kind of get them to that place. But I think that like ideally you're giving families guidance as a therapist that really resonates with them. You know, you're maybe taking things a few steps further or helping illuminate some things that the child is communicating that the parents haven't been able to make sense of yet. But that it like, it fits them, if that makes sense.
Opposite of one size fits all parenting, which I think has its own set of issues of, I mean, it could go in any direction of the comparison game of like, that worked for this person, so it should work for me, and it's not, and I feel broken because of that. Or yeah, like you said, there are best practices in certain places. Like when you're talking to a pediatrician, like, yep, there are vaccines I always recommend you get. Like there are specific ways to do this, that, and the other thing, and that's backed by science, or that's backed by whatever. You should do it.
Yeah, you don't want to like say there's going to be a consequence and then not give a consequence. Like that's just never going to
correct. Correct. Right. But I mean, in that situation, what the consequence is, maybe how you're communicating the consequence, how you anticipate the kid's going to respond to you communicating the consequence, that's all unique to you and your kid. And I think blanket approaches or blanket, you should do this without, but why? What is it supposed to do? Is it going to work for me? Do I want to do that? Like all of these things, people just don't often question that. They just, oh, well, my friend's potty trained this way, so I'm going to potty train this way. And then they're shocked when things don't turn out the same way.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's so many parenting kind of, I don't know, cliches or things that go under that, but it's like making me think again about breastfeeding, you know? So it's like you have something that, you know, science says is good. So it's free. It gives your kid antibodies. It's so nutrient rich. So you should breastfeed. But what if you don't like breastfeeding? What if the baby isn't latching? What if the baby has a really bad tongue tie? You know, what if you, I don't know, have a job? What if you work in the ICU and you have a job where you can't pump? You know, and you can't be near your baby and your milk supply goes down. Like, you know, I think that this is really where people, and I think especially women, are trying to kind of fit a square peg into a circle hole and, you know, end up really beating themselves up, holding themselves to an impossible standard. Like, there are certain things that just don't work for everyone and don't work for everyone's life. Some people just don't have a life that's organized, you know, for breastfeeding for 2 years or
like it's just... Oh my gosh. Yeah. I completely agree. I hated breastfeeding. I did it. I wish I knew. And luckily I have another kid, so I get to make the choices I wish I'd made the first time. But I felt so much pressure to breastfeed. And so I did for 3 months until he went to daycare, and I couldn't stand it. I hated being chained to him at all times, feeling like I had no freedom. I didn't like the physical feeling of it. I didn't like ugly nursing bras. Like, I didn't like any of it, really. And I still persisted for months because I felt like I should. And so this time around, I was like, hell no.
Yeah,
absolutely not. I know what formula I'm going to use. I'm bringing it to the hospital. And everyone at the hospital was actually very supportive. I got like full support of whatever I wanted to do. And it's been so much better for me doing that. And so I wish I would have just let go of those expectations, or like kind of just slipped the middle finger to everyone who was like, oh, you're not breastfeeding. Oh, did he not latch? No, he latched fine. I just don't want to. Thank you.
Yeah.
Like I said, a whole episode on that, I feel like maybe more, because it's a perfect example of expectations or approaches to parenting, or whatever you want to kind of frame it as, that we really feel like need to be debunked or talked about more realistically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what you just said sort of makes me think of two things. I mean, one is I just think the experience, I mean, I've only had one, but from what I hear, especially for your first, they're not limited. Like, I think the experience of having a new child is so overwhelming and is so disruptive that, like, I think it is hard to make some decisions and to locate your gut. You know, it's like there's the pressure, there's the should, there's external voices. You know, I think it really takes, some time and ideally some good support to locate like what's right for you, you know. And in your case, you know, like it sounds like you were able to really make use of your first experience. And it probably, you're telling me about breastfeeding and what you did for the second kid specifically, but like hopefully it wasn't limited to that. You know, hopefully that's one example of how you got rid of other shoulds.
100%. Or even if it wasn't like shoulds from other people, sometimes I think there are a couple things that are also based in what I didn't know at all. Like there was no should. I just did something because I didn't know what else to do or how to do it better. And then, yeah, as a parent, I've grown more trusting of myself, of my partner. And we know, even if it's something we've never done before, or it's a different way or whatever, there is definitely more confidence in being like, okay, I'm just going to assess this situation. I'm going to think about ourselves. I'm going to think about the kid. And we're just going to do what we think needs to be done. And that has grown exponentially with the second kid, and even with the first kid as he's grown. But yeah, I think that's just a lived experience, a learning from a lived experience that maybe not everyone gets to have.
I mean, the other thing is, I'm noticing I haven't used the word ambivalence yet, which when I talk about ambivalence, especially ambivalence in parenting, I'm using it more psychoanalytically, which meaning like being able to hold many feelings all at once. You know, so it's like you not liking certain things about parenting doesn't cancel out your love for your child, all of your hard work, all of your investment. It's like all of these things can exist, you know. But I think talking about ambivalence in parenting, or even like going rogue with something like breastfeeding, I think that it can make people uncomfortable who haven't come to terms with their own ambivalence. And I mean, I think what makes, again, someone's parenting journey, how they feel about parenting is very sort of unique to them. So, I think it can be very frightening for some people to acknowledge the kind of messier parts of that. So I think when you have a person who's like, nope, I'm doing it this way, if you're not comfortable with those own parts of yourself, you get kind of like some distancing or some judgment, you know, from that other person. I think this can be complicated. I think this can be complicated in mother friendships.
Totally. And I think, I mean, I've heard the phrase like the duality of parenthood, where it's like, you are obsessed with your kid and you would die for them. And also like sometimes you want to like throw them out of a window, not literally, but you know, in your mind. And like the parts of the spectrum from the middle down are what so many people don't talk about. Mm-hmm. Everyone feels that way in some format in some shape at some point in their journey. I think, yeah, sharing what you're struggling with or what you aren't enjoying about being a parent can sometimes be met with, like you said, judgment or not wanting to name their own fear or their own challenge. And that kind of brings it to the surface without them wanting to talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you, you know, both from being a mom and from being a therapist and from being a human and from being a woman and all these things, I'm particularly interested from like a mental health perspective, is what do you wish people knew about becoming a parent?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a lot of the things that we touched on today, just around, you know, people talk about a new baby as a blessing and use sort of language like that. Totally. And also, it's like a bomb went off, you know, it's so to sort of like leave room for the disruption, right? And if you're feeling very disrupted, you're not doing it wrong, you know? But I don't know. I think I feel like there can be this thing that happens. Like, I can remember when I was pregnant, and fortunately, I don't have a lot of friends that fell into this category, but I had one. It's like a spouse of a friend. You're like, you don't know what you're in for. Like, I don't mean that. Like, I don't mean, listen, there's no way to know. There's no way to know.
Right.
How you're going to feel and how it's going to play out. And also who you're going to get, right? You don't know who your kid's going to be. You don't know what they're going to be like. So I think just allowing the process to be what it is important. And I think, you know, for partners who are not carrying the pregnancy, like, they need to think of their time and their resources as shared, right? All time, all resources now belong to the family, now belong, in a sense, to the child, especially when they're little and they have a lot of physical needs and are very, very physically tiring, you know? And I'm trying to think of a way to say this without being kind of like hokey, but we live in a very individualist society. And I think even people who like have great friends and great networks, like, you know, I think we were really made to child rear together.
Christina always, really, favorite line is to be like, so when are we moving to the commune?
Yes.
When are we moving to Italy, onto a farm, a commune, where we can all live together and we can have a garden and we'll have animals and we'll raise our kids together? It's her favorite daydream, I think.
Yes, yes. Well, it's a great daydream, and it's a daydream for a reason, you know, which is, and it's not just like an extra set of hands. It's about a shared experience. It's about community. It's about connection. And it's about kids having other kids, right?
Yep.
At all ages, like not just when they're like asking for a play date, but even when they're little blobs. You know, so I think that I would encourage new parents to prioritize in-person things, even if it's like less convenient.
That's another example of kid one versus kid two for us. Was Miller was born in December of 2020. So it was, I had to wear a mask to labor. Like, I literally gave birth in a mask. And so his infancy was very isolated because, you know, he went to daycare. I never saw the inside of his daycare. Not one time. We were never allowed inside with Marie. I mean, she's only a month old, but already she's been to breweries. She's been to friends' houses. Like, you know, we're being safe about germs and all that, especially with the, you know, viral season upon us. But for me, yeah, it's a huge difference. It's not easy to haul ass with, you know, a 1 month old and a toddler
and accoutrements.
Correct. Correct. Even if in the moment it feels hard, the more you do it, the better it feels, and the better it ultimately, like, I think, is good for the parent and the kid.
100%.
Going back to what you were saying about disruption,
mm-hmm.
and that you can't prepare for parenthood in the way that people maybe think you can, but one way of preparing is just to say, I know it's going to be crazy. I know it's going to be very weird. Mm-hmm. And I always described how I felt right after having Miller, like the first couple of months, I felt shell-shocked for months because I was so unprepared for how much was going to change. And I didn't know how it was going to change. I hadn't really thought about that. I just thought about having the kid.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you're supposed to have a kid and you have a baby and it's amazing. And I just was so unprepared for how everything would change.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really excellent point to bring up is like, even if you can't anticipate what the change is going to be, knowing how much is going to change and that it will change is immensely helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And surrender to the change.
That's going to happen.
My biggest challenge, you know, postpartum was, and it took me a while to adjust. In some ways, I'm still adjusting. But, you know, to sort of like, you literally will not be able to do everything you could before because of time. Because, you know, even if you're a really exceptional human, you cannot bend time and space, you know.
Yep. So
there, I think there is a real kind of surrendering, you know, that needs to happen to, you know, life 2.0.
Yep. Life 2.0. I love that. Well, last thing we're going to ask is, where can people find you? Do you have social? Do you have a website?
Well, so I'm afraid of social media, but my website is very easy. It's firstnamelastname.com, heathermayo.com. My last name is spelled May 1. Which I have claimed as my national holiday as well, if anyone would like to put that on their calendars. So that's where you can find me.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for giving your time, and just it was a really thoughtful conversation.
Bye.
Thanks for hanging out with us today. I hope you like what you heard, or if you're just like, yo, these two are my people, don't forget to hit subscribe and leave a review.
And hey, if you want to keep the combo going, come find us on Instagram at @whatiwishiknew_. We are always up for chatting about the real stuff.
We'll be back next time with more expert interviews, real life stories, and a couple of laughs. Till then, remember, we're all in this together. Bye.
Bye.
Every day is something new, but change.